This is Lester Hearn, and you're listening to What Happens When You Die, an exploration of one of the great mysteries, the mystery of death.
My grandfather told me that you see a beautiful white light, and that's where God lives.
When you die, people put you in a box and then put you in a special microwave.
There is also a spa center where people go and rejuvenate themselves.
You go up or you go down. Depends on how you lived your life.
I think when you die, you shit your pants and then pass out.
I traveled to a small suburb just outside of Philadelphia and found myself knocking on the door of a modest home.
Come on in.
I was in the home of Linzer Gunn, the innovator of the Afterlife Helmet, an advanced helmet that allows the moments after death to travel into Gunn's brain via a technological tube. Whippets, which were used to power the helmet, were scattered around the floor, and the smell of cigar smoke hung in the air. Truly the home of a scientist. So what I'm holding here are two helmets attached to each other via a tube, and the helmets themselves seem to be attached to gas masks that connect to nitrous oxide canisters.
Exactly. What makes it special is that this helmet allows me to experience what a dying person is experiencing 2 minutes after their death.
Can you talk about what kind of technology is in these helmets?
The design of the helmet came to me in a dream. I can't go into much more detail. It's top secret. Can I get you a drink?
Now, when did you start using these helmets to study life after death?
I started with dying birds, then sort of moved my way up to bigger mammals until I felt comfortable studying humans.
How does this helmet fit on a bird?
I use much smaller helmets for birds.
Ah. What is the function of this tube? How does it work?
The tube connects the dying person's brain with my brain and allows me to see their last moments. The Whippet canister's function is to get me high.
So what have you experienced through these helmets? What happens when you die?
When you die, you go on a log ride.
You mean like a celestial voyage?
No.
Oh.
It's identical to any log ride you may have gone on at a theme park, the only difference being that your dead relatives are running the ride.
What about for animals?
If you're a bird, then you might see your bird mother pressing a green button on the ride.
Huh.
If you're a human, then it's a grandmother or great-grandmother or mom.
What happens after the log ride?
I don't know.
Why?
The helmet only allows me to see 2 minutes after death, and
oh.
The log ride seems to be longer than 2 minutes.
How do you find people to participate in these experiments?
It's not that hard. I just hang out at bus stations and invite people over to my house.
Wait, Mr. Gunn, you're not saying that you murder people,
If you call putting someone on a log ride murder, then I'm guilty as charged. Why don't you let me show you? Have you ever heard of autoerotic asphyxiation?
Yeah, I've heard of autoerotic asphyxiation. Of course, I love it.
Me too. Put my helmet on and let's get going.
We both took our clothes off and began to autoerotic asphyxiate. Gunn had a beautiful body. His rippling muscular abdominal muscles reminded me of a war soldier. Just as I was about to pass out while simultaneously having an orgasm, a beautiful woman walked in from another room. She was wearing a full-body leather suit and red high heels.
I hope you didn't really believe my husband's bullshit helmet story, she said. He's a pathological liar, and I'm so sick of his shit. And to punish him, I want you to fuck me in front of him all night long.
We spend the entire night fucking in front of her husband, laughing at his stupid helmet, and enjoying each other's bodies. And so the great mystery remains just that. I promise you that this will not discourage me. I will continue exploring the great mystery of what happens after we die, and I hope you'll come along with me for the ride. My name is Lester Hearn, and this has been What Happens When You Die. And now a word from our sponsors.
Spring is here, but you're all shook up. But you wanna fuck, but you don't know what to do. Get some Blue Chew tablets in you. It'll do for your dick what the sun does for flowers.
That song's by me, not Blue Chew. They didn't make me sing that. And maybe it's not completely scientifically accurate that it will do for your dick what the sun does for flowers, but it is scientifically accurate to say that Blue Chew contains the exact same ingredients as Viagra and Cialis, but in chewable tablets and at a fraction of the cost. I can go on and on with all the great things about Blue Chew, like no visits to the doctor's office, no waiting in line in the pharmacy, no getting bullied by people who somehow have a stigmatized boner pills. But the best thing I can tell you is I've tried them. I have a subscription to these things and they work. I'm a 47 or 4, I don't even remember how old I am. Let's just say that this old man's penis isn't exactly what you would call in tip-top shape sometimes, all right? There was a fucking pandemic and I've got 2 kids. All right, so God bless Blue Chew for the sweet, sweet gift of its powerful, powerful, magical medicine. I don't know what it does. It's great. I don't know why it works like it does. It doesn't matter to me. It just works, and I hope that you'll give it a shot. We've got a special deal for you. Try Blue Chew free when you use our promo code Duncan at checkout. Just pay $5 shipping. That's bluechew.com, promo code Duncan, to receive your first month free. You can go to bluechew.com for more details and important safety information. All you got to do is head over there. You're going to consult with one of their licensed medical providers. And once you're approved, you'll receive your prescription within days. Again, it's bluechew.com, promo code Duncan, for free when you use that promo code. Thank you, Blue Chew, for sponsoring the DTFH. And now a word from my dear friend, Dr. Morisano, who is putting on a wonderful psychedelic event in Canada this weekend. Hope you can make it.
Hi, my name is Dr. Dominique Morisano, and I'm here to tell you about an exciting event this weekend, a one-time nonprofit conference on psychedelic science. From research to reality, Global Summit on Psychedelic-Assisted Therapies and Medicine, #R2R2022, is a first-of-its-kind event on the state of research on psychedelics and their transition to the real world. Planned and supported by international leaders in the field and co-hosted by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, the Mental Health Commission of Canada, and the Canadian Center on Substance Use and Addiction, the conference will be offered live-streamed and in-person in Toronto this Friday to Sunday. If you're not up for a full 3 days, on Saturday, May 28th, 7:30 Eastern, there'll be a special 90-minute in-person live stream public event with global psychedelics experts Drs. David Nutt, Monica Williams, Olivia Marcus, Rick Doblin from MAPS, Don D. Davis, and Ifitayo Harvey, founder of the People of Color Psychedelic Collective. Priced at only 35 Canadian or 28 US dollars, this event is for anyone curious about psychedelic therapies. For DTFH listeners, we're offering a 20% off code for the big event, R2R1943DTFH. For more info, visit FromResearchReality.com.
Thanks, Dr. Morisano. Now, friends, today we have a glorious podcast for you. Jason Louvre. You know him maybe as the Soul Bird from the Midnight Gospel. He's also one of my dear friends, and he is a sorcerer, wizard, teacher, you name it, Buddhist, everything you would want in a person. Does he seem like someone who would definitely be hanging out in the library of Miskatonic University? Yes. Is he hilarious? Absolutely. Does he have a wonderful website? Of course. Magic.me. Go there. Do you know what he's doing? Virtual reality rituals. If you want to learn ceremonial magic, what better way to learn it than in VR? Before we jump into it, won't you come see me in Philadelphia? I'm sorry for all the plugs and promos here. I'm going to be at the Helium Comedy Club in Philadelphia on June 9th, 10th, and 11th. June 9th, 10th, and 11th. If this sounds weird, it's because in a previous version of this episode, I said the wrong date. Helium, Philadelphia, June 9th, 10th, and 11th. All my other dates are at DuncanTrussell.com. Denver, San Francisco, you name it, I'm coming there. Go to DuncanTrussell.com. You'll find it there. All right, everybody. Without further ado, please welcome back to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour, the Soul Bird from the Midnight Gospel, Jason Louvre.
Thank you.
Jason, welcome back.
Hello.
Hello. I was watching The Ninth Gate. Do you remember that movie, The Ninth Gate?
Fuck yes, I remember that movie. I love that movie. I rewatched it recently, actually. Boris Becker, the guy in the suit, is like one of my all-time favorite occult characters. Only Jason, I am fit to hold the secret of the book when he marches in on all the people in robes. I love that.
It's so good. The whole time I was thinking of you and thinking how great it is that we're going to be talking tomorrow. The whole time, like, this is glue.
It's a great movie. Other than it was directed by Roman Polanski, which is a little sketch, but
Polanski directed that shit. Oh, yeah. No kidding. Yeah, well, I had no idea.
He may not be a good human being, but he, much like Mel Gibson, he is still a great director, if not a good human being. So,
right, yeah, you know what? Just watch it like I did and pretend he didn't direct it, and you won't be bothered by any kind of weird cognitive dissonance.
Well, it is a movie about the devil, so I mean, you know, it kind of adds to that, I suppose.
He loves those movies, huh? It's so odd that someone like that would love those kinds of movies. Would love making those kinds of movies.
I know. It's weird. One of life's funny little quirks.
Well, I mean, how much, as an occult scholar, practitioner...
It still weirds me out when people say this to me.
You are!
In my mind, I am literally... I'm literally just a Dungeons and Dragons nerd that never snapped out of it. Like, literally, that's my self-image. I'm not even exaggerating. That is my self-image.
No, Everyone writes books on John D. Everyone writes compendiums on John. No, we all do. All Dungeon Masters. When they're not running a campaign, they're hard at work writing about some of the great modern occultists.
I'm just DMing at scale now for a ton of people. Yeah, I'm setting the rules of reality for quite a few people and DMing, but it's fun. Just like I was always a good DM. I always was the DM. You might imagine. Yeah.
How much of that movie, when you're watching it, as someone who knows so much about the occult, when you're watching a thing like that, is it like a doctor watching like a hospital show? When you're seeing some of the like pictures in the book, or just the ideas that Polanski's presenting about the possibility of fucking yourself over with cursed books or summoning the devil, how much of that, when you're watching that, how much you're like, oh, that's pretty on track, or that's just garbage?
I think that movie is actually pretty good. I think if you just take it as like a satire of occult people, it gets a lot right. Not all the devil appearing and lighting, no spoilers, but like all like the silly Star Wars stuff, but the bits that movie really gets right are the fact that it's all about books. Like occult people are just they're just rare book collectors.
Wow.
You know, they're just people who are obsessed with books. I mean, you think about it, like what is an occult book? It's a book that promises you some power. So who's going to be interested in that? Powerless people who read a lot of books. You know, that sense, it is an extension from like D&D and just being like the kid in the library at lunch hour, you know, that's who I was. So, it gets that right. You know, like occultists are just rare book collectors. And then it gets, but the whole like Euro, eyes wide shut, like European people who take this shit way too seriously, it definitely got that right, and it's hilarious. And the bit with the Boris Becker, I think that's his name, unless that's the football person. Him, like, there's a character who is just kind of wears a suit and thinks that that all of these people wearing robes are just completely ridiculous. Yeah. That's I love that. That's like so on point. So, and Johnny Depp is a great character in that movie. He's like the archetypal occult detective, but making the hero a book collector, like, that's totally on point.
What's interesting is that somehow Johnny Depp really pulled off playing like a non-passive book collector. Somehow they turned being a book collector into something cool and like sexy. Like all his movements were so weirdly like hot, you know.
I think that movie's probably, because I saw that in the theater when I was whatever 19 or whenever it came out, 18 I think, 17 maybe, I can't, I think, no, 18, whatever. Anyways, but Yeah, and it was just like, that was one of those early formative movies. It was like, yeah, like I can be like a nerd, but like alpha and Chad if I
That's
get into
right.
the occult.
Yeah, he was so alpha. He was like a super alpha book collector.
Yeah, there's a lot of great movies. By the way, if you like that movie, a great one that goes with that is Angel Heart with Mickey Rourke.
Oh, give me
from
a
the
break.
80s.
That's what I was trying to figure out is... You know, which came, so Angel Heart came first. So basically, spoiler, watch both these movies, then come back to this podcast, because the Polanski ripped off Angel Heart. That's all I was thinking is like, this is so many things seem to be borrowed from Angel Heart here. Definitely both characters were kind of identical, you know, detective types, right?
Yeah, well, that's just an old literary trope, but I'm a sucker for like the John Constantine style, you know, like kind of down on his luck, occult, hard-boiled, definitely on the comes from the wrong side of the tracks, you know, getting mixed up with shady women and that type of thing, you know, like I grew up with that stuff always, right? Especially with John Constantine, always.
Yeah.
They actually interviewed me for the new John Constantine animated movie, so I'm actually on the DVD. Yeah, it was really weird.
Whoa,
but it was
cool.
I was really excited about that. So
I mean,
City of Demons, that one.
You always kind of downplay the robe stuff, and I get that in the sense. I mean, nobody. I hate costume parties, right? It's the worst when someone invites you to a dress code party. I hate it so much. And I guess the robe rituals are sort of the same. But I gotta ask, man, that the underlying idea that you can fuck your whole life up by coming into contact with some of these books, I don't mean it like in a metaphorical way. Like, I know you run into some shitty books, you can fuck your life up, you know, like, but I mean, like, in a literal sense, do you think there's truth to the warnings in many of these grimoires, which is always sort of like, don't fuck with this stuff or you could get in a lot of trouble?
When was the first pod? How long have we been doing podcasts together for?
I don't know, man. I don't want
like
to
five,
think about
because this was literally the first question you asked me on the first podcast we did, or one of the first ones.
Well,
so you're still freaking out about it, huh?
No, I'm not freaking out about it. I romanticize it, and honestly, I want that to be true.
Well,
I want
there
to be magic books.
There are definitely magic books. I'll be totally straightforward about it. Can magic in general, just like anything else? I mean, really, the question is: can holding illusions mess up your life? Yeah, but you don't need a magic book for that. You can believe that you're, I don't know, destined to be the greatest lawyer in history and just fuck everyone else over getting to the top. But it's all an illusion. So
right.
I'll give you the Buddhist answer. It's like, I mean, magic is dangerous in, it's not like Hollywood dangerous. It's just the main danger with magic is wasting your time if you don't have the right approach, and wasting time out of your life and thinking things are real that aren't. And so I think that the proper way to approach magic is simply from the Buddhist perspective that it's all mind. Once you understand that it's empty of actual reality, it's like, here's the thing. This is, magic itself is such a Zen cone. It's kind of a Zen cone on the step to pure meditative practice, but it's also really cool and useful and fun. But it's particularly cool and useful and fun if you have a proper understanding of the nature of mind. And so the thing about magic is it demonstrates that you can do all these, like, you can do magic and you'll get all the results just like in the books. And multiple, it's not scientific, but it's empirical in the sense that multiple people can do the same thing and pretty much get the same results. I've got endless stories like that. But the issue is, why did it happen? And then once you start thinking, it's like, you know, why could I do this? And I did this ritual, and then this bizarre set of coincidences happened within the next week that got me the job I wanted or whatever like that. So, well, what? Or I had a vision of an angel or whatever it happens to be. It's like you start to realize, well, is it real? You start to ask, like, is it real? Is it not real? And there's really no answer to that question. But then that question itself bleeds over into the rest of your life. And then you're just like, well, what is anything real or not real? And eventually, right, if you get through it, this is Chapel Perilous, as Bob Wilson used to call it. If you get through that, hopefully you get to what the Tibetan Buddhists like are so clear about. It's like everything is mind, and it's empty of inherent reality. It's quote unquote real on its own plane.
Yeah.
But it itself has no ultimate meaning. And then it's like, okay. So once you get the understanding, it's like, well, it's not really real, but nothing's real. So, you know, it's fun.
Yeah, right. It's kind of like...
But if you take it seriously and you're like, I'm really talking to aliens, like, yeah, you're going to have a bad time.
Well, I mean, unless the aliens are real, real, in which case they're going to be annoyed that you're like, I know you're not real. And
yeah,
they're like,
yeah.
You just saw me land this fucking thing. I mean, well, how, like...
Well, but are you talking to them? That's the question.
What, am I talking to aliens?
Yeah,
hell
you specifically. Are you sure?
I'm talking, I mean, I'm
how
about
how would you
as
know? What if they speak to you in feelings and intuitions and you don't even realize it's them?
I don't think there's anything closer to aliens than toddlers, truly. They're new to the planet. They don't know what any of this stuff is. And they also have their own language. It's pretty much identical, I would guess. The way I'm hearing what you're saying is, in this reality, don't fall for the idea that the paint is dry, so to speak. The paint is wet. You can still alter the painting in all kinds of ways. So has a spell been cast on people intentionally to make them think the paint is dry, to make them think the painting's done? Who cast the spell?
And they did.
Who are they?
The people that are in that reality.
I want to thank Sunday for supporting this episode of the DTFH. Friends, I have two wonderful children who love to play in the yard, which is why I like Sunday, because I know that my lawn is not polluted with Chernobyl-style harsh chemicals. Sunday is made with ingredients that you can actually pronounce, like seaweed, iron, and molasses. The best part, it works. Do you really want to have fun this summer on your yard that is covered in the same shit that brought the swamp thing to life? Does your lawn have weeds, bare patches, or pet spots? Sunday can help you solve all these problems and more the easy way. They've got everything you need, from fertilizer to seeds to weed control, and it's all delivered right to your door. It will make your lawn look like a swath of the Garden of Eden instead of some kind of chameleon-like lawn that maybe looks okay, but underneath it is bubbling with shit that makes God angry, that drips down into the earth and kills bugs and things down at the center of the earth till it drips out of the ceiling of the hollow earth into the eyeballs of whatever advanced beings live under the earth and causes them to go blind. Don't do that to our planet. Use healthy things on your lawn. It's your personal oasis. It deserves the best. Sunday helps you grow a beautiful lawn, control pests, and fight weeds without the toxic stuff. It's super effective and easy. You just go to sunday.com, put in your address, and their lawn analysis tool does the rest. They use soil and climate data to create a personal nutrient plan delivered to your door right when you need it. Sunday's lawn care products are made with your family in mind. That's why they use ingredients you can feel good about. Again, it's seaweed, iron, and molasses. Sunday is offering our listeners 20% off. Full season plans start at just $129. You get 20% off when you visit getsunday.com/Duncan at checkout. That's 20% off your custom plan at getsunday.com/Duncan. Cast the spell and
then they did.
Who are they?
The people that are in that reality. It's not a top-down thing. I mean, people are the social trends, or as Michel Foucault called it, consensus reality. I think that was Foucault.
Okay,
is basically reality is agreed upon, and this is kind of the core of postmodern academic theory. Kind of. Don't quote me. It's been a while since I was in school, but you know, reality is. You know, or even the social contract is an agreement between people to play the game in a certain way.
Right.
right? I mean, like, our entire, like, all of existence is essentially an agreement between groups of people to do things in a certain way. And when those rules are violated, we experience it as a rupture of the divine order of things. But it's really not the divine order. It's the human order of things. And so, right. like, when you're, every day, you're like, the world's going to hell. Everything's falling apart. It's like, well, maybe the human agreement on how the game is supposed to be played is being severely challenged or is not holding up.
Right.
And to be a magical thinker is to realize, like, none of that is actually there. But the reason it's there is not because, like, Tucker Carlson is waving a wand in a robe, you know, chanting to him. Maybe he is. I don't know. He's apparently a deadhead and is into synths. So you and Tucker Carlson may be two aspects of the same person. Because you're both, it's like, it's the synth thing. I saw him interviewed on a synth podcast. Yes, he does. I saw it. Look it up.
So,
or like a synth person. Like a synth person interviewed him on a YouTube podcast, and they were talking about synths and the Grateful Dead. And I was like, "This is, sounds like one of the, wait, what? What's going on here?" So there's reality breaking for you.
There you go, friends. A spell cast by a true wizard has shattered my reality. What?
But aren't we all ultimately the same person, anyways? You know, so that's the thing. Reality is an agreement between the potentially infinite beings to play the game in a certain way.
Right.
But the reason is not nefarious. It's because, you know, try agreeing on anything with one person. The fact that we all have a social agreement that allows life to pretty much function is nothing short of miraculous.
Right.
And the reason it's, and so it, by and large, it works really well, to the point that when it doesn't work, we experience it as something horribly wrong, instead of things going wrong constantly. I mean, not like now, but at the level of, like, you know, like the charnel fields of Europe break down, World War II, like everything, just, you know, atom bombs, like all of that. The fact that we don't normally, I mean, well, to be fair, that is happening in Ukraine right now.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, the fact that when we see things, the rules breaking down, we experience it as utterly traumatic shows that we're not used to it happening all the time, which shows that the things work pretty well, actually.
It was working. And then what's the problem? Is the problem that when things are breaking down, we keep trying to play the same game. Like, if we are in a house and we're playing hide and go seek and the house catches on fire, you would be a complete dummy to keep playing hide and go seek in a burning house. And yet it's like that house apparently is on fire, and the people running the show, the theys, are like, no, 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 no. We're playing hide and go seek, and we're going to keep playing hide and go seek because that's what we do in this house. This is the game that we know. And then the house burns down, and the people who were dumb enough to keep playing whatever the game was are incinerated. And then the people who got out of the house, they go, like, recover whatever they can from the wreckage and rebuild the whole thing. That's kind of what's been going on with civilization for a long time.
Yeah, but the thing is, I mean, people always get angry about the state of things, and they always get angry, like, why are people like this? They'll never change. It's like, well, that's not... Most people want to experience existence rather than constantly have the burden of changing it or changing the rules. They just want to experience what life is. And so it's quite, you know, my perspective of the healthiest role for an artist or a magician or just a creative person, an engineer, a creative thinker, inventor, to play in society is just the same as it was in tribal culture with shamans or philosopher kings. That never actually happened, but the kind of the philosopher in ancient Greece, where it's, you have somebody who is aware that everything is a game, but is able to, from that, reconstruct the, basically is able to DM for other people in a way that keeps them happy, safe, and sane.
Right.
Because ultimately it is all pure chaos, but people can't function like that.
No.
So they need somebody to kind of essentially DM who's able to, and that is a spell. It's like you construct a more, and we need that right now because things are kind of are, the system's definitely being challenged, but that's normal. You know, it's like your immune system is constantly being challenged. That's good. I mean, I'm not saying that individual tragedies or anything like this are good. It's just that the system is self-correcting, I think. And it's hard these days. It's really hard, but I try to have at least a little bit of faith in it. Not the system as in the government, which I've that's a whole other conversation. But in terms of just the system of human beings are endlessly creative and adaptable.
Right.
And we always seem to work it out. We always seem to wake up the next morning, you know, except
right.
when we don't, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, don't get me started on the government.
See, you are Tucker.
No, I think that the part of the problem, though, it's to, at least personally, is when I forget the paint's still wet. You co-create. You can work with this stuff. It's more malleable than you could ever possibly imagine. When I start looking at my own life or the world as this crystallized thing, and I'm the little bug stuck in it, that's when depression hits. But the moment you start realizing, holy shit, this is really wet clay that I just haven't had the guts to reach out and try to shape, that's when you get this spark.
Yeah.
That's what I love about magic, that aspect of it.
That's why having a magical practice is really useful, because it's really hard. And I'm constantly struggling with the same thing. When you get into that place where you're kind of sunken in and you're like, nothing's, you know, just like this total, that kind of like black pilled hopeless place, nothing's working, everything's
yeah.
just, it's so hard to get out of that. And that's why it's really useful to be like, oh, kind of have like a like in the true sense ritual action, like, you know, you, well, okay, but I feel terrible, but maybe I can go do a little you know, like a banishing ritual and a meditation and just do this stuff. I don't feel like doing it. Whenever you're really depressed, you're always like, oh, you know, that's all bullshit,
yeah.
whatever. But it's like, but if you do it, then things will immediately start kind of improving. So it's good to have a ritualized action that you can do, particularly when you get to that place of overwhelm, I think.
Well, what is there anything you're aware of in the quote literature that talks about that strange internal entropy or that kind of wall that appears psychologically between you and the ritual, where even though you might have had a thriving practice, even though you might have had incredible results, even though you kind of vaguely remember, anytime I start doing this stuff again, my life instantaneously improves. Is there any, does anyone ever talk about that thing that sets in where you begin to forget all of that and sink down into like a sad entropic
yeah.
state?
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of different things about that. I think probably the most useful one is Peter Carroll, the Chaos Magician, talked about the psychic sensor, which is that function in your brain that is constantly, in his way of thinking, it was like it's constantly convincing you that magic is not happening all the time.
Okay.
And it's like whenever something magical or synchronistic or perhaps supernatural happens, it's that part of your brain that comes in and says like, no, you didn't actually see that, you know?
Right.
It's like, yeah. So, the other thing is it's probably not that helpful to talk about theosophical terms, but Blavatsky, cause it's so woo, but Blavatsky
yeah.
did have this concept of the dweller on the threshold, which is, this kind of being that's a backdrag on your progress that is composed of all your prior karma.
Holy fuck.
That has to be overcome, yeah, across many lifetimes. So I don't like
Whoa.
To get into like super new age theosophical woo stuff, because it's like, but it's certainly like cool from like a Marvel Comics perspective.
The dweller on the threshold?
The dweller on the threshold, yeah. And
Ugh.
It's basically the first thing that you have to do when you start doing magic is confront the dweller on the threshold, which is not just like your darker negative side. It's like the complete accreted karma across all lifetimes of your negative actions, personified as a being.
Okay.
So it's really like so for you, that's clearly Tucker Carlson.
No,
right?
It's not Tucker Carlson. It's one of our fucking dogs. No, truly, that makes me think Blatovsky had a fucking dog, because we have this older dog that sits when it's raining, will not go out to pee and sits at the edge of the threshold of the house until you like get distracted enough so that she'll come back in the house and shit and piss somewhere. You know what I mean? That's what I
there
think
you go.
Of when I think of dweller on the threshold.
There you go.
Something if you don't pay attention to it, will shit in your house.
Well, that's
no matter
just
what.
Like that. I mean, that you just described my own ongoing struggle with myself. You know, it's like just when you think you're like great and you've over, it's like, yeah, your own dark side sneaks in and shits in the house and fucks everything up. It's like, God damn it, not
I'm
again.
So happy we're talking about this. because this has been now whenever I start having any kind of, I don't know, like meditation-based epiphany, anytime I get any sense of like I'm waking from the dream of life, now I'm like, oh no, you're having that dumb sense again that inevitably leads to an awful collapse. It's almost like that is now a red flag for me where it's like, oh shit, watch out. You're starting to think you're getting enlightened. That means you're about to like do something really dumb. What is that's the dweller on the threshold? What is
that's
that?
That's something else. Those are phenomena created by the mind during the enlightenment process going forward.
So you think I'm getting enlightened? I'm just kidding.
The Democrats want you to believe. You might think you're getting enlightened, but sleepy Joe Biden.
If only that was the reality we were in. That was the economy was based on people getting enlightened, like the Dow Jones enlightenment average, how many people are getting enlightened or not.
I just love it. Like Tucker Carlson is the drill. It's like, you know, you're getting enlightened. I know everyone knows they're getting enlightened. We all agree on that. You're a sane person. You're a rational person. But you wouldn't think that if you listened to Joe Biden and the Democrats.
While Americans across this great nation are getting enlightened on a daily basis, sleepy Joe Biden is allowing unenlightened immigrants in at the border. They have not achieved samadhi. They have not achieved any sense of nirvana, and yet they are flooding in, unenlightening our children.
You know, that's funny because that's like probably literally what Buddhists would be like if they ever got their way.
What?
Trying to build an enlightened society. That's what they would have their own Tucker Carlson trying to keep the unenlightened out.
Buddhist like, fascism.
Oh yeah, well that's actually unfortunately real, like in Myanmar and things like that. But yeah,
I mean,
everyone
can
be a dick.
Absolutely. I don't know how somehow the Buddhism has become immune to the scathing eye of the secularist, because it is true. Anytime generally, anytime angry people get a hold of anything, they'll fuck it up, whatever it is, especially something that has so many intangibles in it, you know, that like Buddhism or whatever. That's so interesting, man. I don't mind talking about Blavatsky. My reason for not talking about Blavatsky wouldn't necessarily be because of like New Age associations, but because of shit I've read about her being just a complete con artist and fraud, setting up traps and tricks in the ceiling to like drop
the ceiling.
Yeah, you never read about that?
No. Okay. Ceiling cat?
Well, she had a cat in a trap door. As part of her, as part of the game, she apparently had something built into her ceiling, like a trap door, a little tiny trap door that you could, you know, push a button, and so she made weird. A letter fall out, you know, to prove, you know, because when they were doing their seances and all that, they were like using all kinds of tricks. Isn't this what Houdini was into exposing?
Yeah. He was kind of like he was a bit of a soy boy for his time, you know, like exposing the new atheist type. But it was great though. Yeah, no, I think that was very common at the time. I mean, and it's still common. I mean, there is still a psychic mafia and all of this type of thing. So people cult reading and kind of like running protection rackets for spiritual readers and things like this.
Wait, but, what? Describe that. What do you mean?
Oh, that's pretty straightforward. I mean, like you've seen these like card reader like or psychics on every street corner, like where they have neon in the window where it's palm reading, all that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a mafia just like with its own protection racket, just like any other kind of small business circuit.
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, you mean you go in there and you tell them your secrets and they fuck with you?
I don't know. I don't know enough to intelligently talk about this. The books have been written about it. It's more like you have to pay your protection to be doing the business to the people who are kind of overseeing those shops. You can't just set up your shop.
Just put a psychic thing on the corner. If you do, someone's going to come to you and be like, hey, this isn't Hogwarts, asshole. This is...
Yeah, it's like you got to pay us to do this in this neighborhood type of thing. I think that's the deal. But anyways,
wow.
But there's tons of con stuff. I don't know. I've never heard that about Blavatsky. I think I've read her books. They're super fun, particularly and Secret Doctrine is super interesting. But... I don't know. I mean, like, but the history of the Theosophical Society is bizarre. They almost took over a large part of India. in the early, in the 1910s or 20s, where basically they had this whole scheme where they were going to, because they were huge, like everyone was into it. They were like a big, big deal. And, but they were going to prop up this kid, Krishnamurti, as the world teacher.
Yeah.
And then, and, but now it turns out that his handler, Charles Ledbetter, was molesting him the whole time as a kid. And it's, and, you know, while they were priming him to be this world teacher. And then possibly as, because of that, he broke with the, he basically just rage quit when he wasn't even that old. He just rage quit. He's like, fuck your world teacher shit. And then he went on to actually be a really good spiritual teacher.
Now I get it. Now I get it. Because Krishnamurti was kind of like the Houdini for gurus, right? Like,
that's why. They tried. They were grooming him to be like the old, the Messiah, basically. And then he, to his credit, he was just like, no. Can you imagine?
They were, yeah. They basically plucked up this Indian kid and tried to pull off like a Dune Messiah.
They were trying to
form a Messiah. And then this guy Ledbetter was an abuser. I vaguely remember hearing that, and I'm sorry I forgot it the last time I was talking shit about Krishnamurti, because now it all makes sense.
Oh yeah.
Thank you, Super Speciosa, for supporting this episode of the DTFH. Kratom is an all-natural herb related to the coffee plant that has been used in Thailand for centuries and has been being put in my mouth ever since I got endorsed by the gods over at Super Speciosa. I call them gods because this kratom that they are producing is incredible. You want to wind down and relax after work without pouring vodka down your chew hole? This is a great way to do it. Or maybe in smaller servings, you want something for pre-workout or post-workout recovery. Super Speciosa has got the kratom for you. I recommend the capsules. I'm not fucking around with the powder. Maybe you're an advanced kratom user or something, but I'm not. I don't have time to measure stuff. I just take some of these wonderful capsules, and holy God in heaven, it is amazing. Even better, our offer code can be used again and again, meaning that if you've already used the offer code to order some of this stuff, you can use it again. I recommend their Green MD strain, by the way, if you're looking for something to start off with. You can just go to their website. They've got all the data you need on the various strains, but you can try it now and get 20% off. All you got to do is go to superleaf.com/Duncan. You get 20% off with promo code Duncan. That's getsuperleaf.com/Duncan. Use promo code Duncan for 20% off. Thank you, Super Speciosa.
I mean, the thing about Buddhism, just like any other religion, dharma, is that, like you said, it adapts itself everywhere it goes. I don't think that anyone owns it. I think that for that reason, it's important to go back to the Pali. If you want to study Buddhism, go back to the Pali Canon. We actually have the original discourses. Like, that's what I would study. But, like, I would say that, for instance, in America, for instance, because, you know, Hinduism and Buddhism are something totally different in America. I would argue that both Hinduism and Buddhism in the U.S. have essentially just become a vehicle for baby boomer values. They have a lot more to do with the values of the baby boomer generation and at propping themselves up as Buddhist and Hindu teachers than they do with the actual original religions. There's a writer named David Chapman who's a really interesting blogger who calls this consensus Buddhism. And he basically says this was done for marketing reasons by particularly the Dalai Lama. They just want the tradition to survive, you know.
What?
But you go to like a Vipassana retreat and it's like nothing like, you know, feel good baby boomer Buddhism. It's more like, you know, being in a Thai prison or something like that, which I personally love. not being in prison, but like the Hellraiser experience. I mean, Buddhism is dark and incredibly strenuous.
Yeah.
And so, but the thing about Buddhism is it has the whole skillful means, upaya idea of you kind of like sell people the feel good stuff to get them into it. But Buddhism at its core is a doctrine of extinction. It's a doctrine of extincting yourself across all lifetimes.
So is
you don't
it
have
really?
To so oh. you don't have to reincarnate.
Well, I mean, okay. Maybe so. But isn't it also sort of like, I mean, isn't it also extinction and not extinction? Isn't it also everythingness and nothingness? It's like the middle way in between these two things. In other words, like, yeah, absolute reality, you're already extinct. Absolute reality, what even are you other than some, you know, tiny little sentient little blurbling thing that's being dissolved right now into everythingness, which already exists. In other words, yes, annihilation, but not annihilation, right?
But,
it's not just one or the, it's not just...
It's pretty much extinction. I mean, yeah, that's a stage you get to, but I mean, the point of Buddhism is total cessation of mental phenomena.
But
it's a totalizing goal.
Right, but the mental phenomena, but there's still like a, the, what is it, what is, ex, isn't the, I guess it is extinction, but the idea is like, you're already extinct. You know what I mean? Like, don't worry. The thing you think is real is nothing anyway. The extinction is already here. It's not an event that you get to. You're already extinguished, so to speak. All, you know, gone, already broken, everything shattered. You know, it's done. It's done. Thus, relax into extinction. And yet, you're still here.
In a sense, I think. And but if that was 100% true, there would be no reason for the path at all. And I think that's like, ultimately, yes. Okay. But you're still like, the thing is, you're still identified with the illusion.
Heart Sutra, baby. Right. That's what
I love
it says.
Heart Sutra.
The Heart Sutra is saying it's already empty. It's just the Dharma itself empty. The heart attacks. You're the one who told me about that the first time. I've confirmed that with various people. Honestly, when you told me, I kind of didn't believe you. I'm like, what the fuck? But many, every, you told me that when people heard the Heart Sutra around, when Buddha gave the original sermon, that people died. People had heart attacks.
I definitely did not tell you that. I've never heard that.
I
so it must have been someone else.
I could have
maybe
sworn
you
it was
maybe you,
you
dream me telling you.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the, I mean, again, is that really what happened? But people
who
say
knows?
Well, anyway, maybe before we talk about
am
that,
I even the same person sitting here as I was 2 years ago? I could have been replaced.
Man, I don't know. I don't know. Me too. Now, wait. Give a quick synopsis of the Heart Sutra for people who might not be familiar with it.
So the Heart Sutra is, gate paraksamgate bodhisvaha, is... It's basically it's really good to read. It's very comforting. It basically establishes that nirvana is samsara as samsara is nirvana and everything's fine. And essentially what you're saying, which is really good, although you have to I'm not a Buddhist scholar by any means, but I will point out that the Heart Sutra is a Mahayana text. So it comes from Buddhism's missionary phase when they were trying to spread it to the whole world. And it's there's nothing in the original Pali canon that suggests that things are already done. The Pali Canon is just the original turning of the Dharma is just here's the steps you need to do to get out of suffering.
Right.
And so it's a I would say I hate to abuse the word scientific, but it's a step by step process that to be undertaken. And when you're in states of Buddhist meditation, which I don't claim to be an expert, although I've definitely experienced them in things like doing Vipassana and whatnot, I've experienced a ton of states of consciousness in a ton of other traditions. Has nothing to do with, you know, it's, I would say it's operative in your normal consciousness, but the thing is that you are totally, disidentified with it. And it's not, I don't think it's like you get to a point and you're done, because then if you go back, if you break, that state, then you're in a different state. You know, it's like you go back to your old pattern. So, but I'm not a Buddhist scholar or advanced practitioner or anything of that type, but
here's the Heart Sutra. Body is nothing, and you know, when they read it, it's like, but I'll read it a little bit of it. Body is nothing more than emptiness. Emptiness is nothing more than body. The body is exactly empty. The emptiness is exactly body. The other four aspects of human existence, feeling, thought, will, and consciousness, are likewise nothing more than emptiness, and emptiness nothing more than they. All things are empty. Nothing is born. Nothing is died. Nothing dies. Nothing is pure. Nothing is stained. Nothing increases. Nothing decreases. So in emptiness, there is no body, no feeling, no thought, no will, no consciousness. There are no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. There is no seeing, no hearing. No, Jason, it's not about extinction. No seeing, no hearing, no smelling, no tasting, no touching. This isn't about extinction. So, what do you mean? There is no ignorance. There's no extinction here. There is no. This is an extinction. No.
Somebody's dweller on the threshold is acting up. So, but here's my question, right? From what state of consciousness was that written, and who was it written for?
Wow.
I don't know the answer to that, but in looking at most spiritual texts, I mean, it's really easy to read
That's
things.
Cool.
That makes those things may it's kind of like when you're on someone you know is on psychedelics and suddenly something makes total sense to you.
Yeah.
Like you list, like, for instance, the classic one is you do psychedelics, someone you know does psychedelics and then goes and listens to psychedelic music from the 60s and you're like, oh my god, I totally get it now.
Yeah,
this is amazing. Or my favorite is, and I think actually all music is like that, my favorite is I was in a bar a while ago watching Saturday Night Live. Not Saturday Night Live, Saturday Night Fever, the disco movie.
Yeah.
And I was just like watching, like, I don't think it was that. It was like that era, but it was all this footage of people dancing with like leisure suits and with like gold medallions and like chains and like dancing like they're Gumby. And I was like, I always thought this was the worst thing ever, but I was looking at this and I was like, you know what? This probably made perfect fucking sense on Quaaludes.
Oh, shit.
This was probably awesome on Quaaludes. I mean, nobody has Quaaludes anymore, so I don't know. But it's like they were probably all like relaxed and loose and sweaty, so they didn't want constricting clothing. They just wanted to like Gumby out all over the place.
Oh,
it's like this was probably made total sense on Quaaludes.
Holy shit, you're right. I'm guessing you're right. Again, I've never had Quaaludes. It's one of the things,
one of
the many things that have gone extinct. Sadly.
Yeah, sadly, all phenomena are impermanent.
Especially
Quaaludes.
But it's kind of you can go to Mexico and get them, but I don't know if that's true.
I wouldn't fuck with, like, or someone I know has had that thought, but apparently the police do not fuck around there, especially with American drug tourists. So hey, I would.
Well, I've heard you just bring enough money to give, like, who am I? Who's telling me these things? Probably not the best people on earth, but what I've heard is the idea is like, yeah, they don't fuck around with it unless you pay them to let you fuck around with it. You can't go there and expect to like pull off. You have to pay off the cartels, or somebody.
You're assuming all that goes well. You know what I mean? It's like,
I would never do it. Are you fucking kidding?
No,
this is just
either.
Shit I've heard
yeah.
from like, you know, drug addicts who would go to Mexico to buy pills.
Super
like
sketch.
I've heard stories about this from people who are deeply addicted to drugs.
Because I think they expect that. They definitely expect that there too. You know, you might imagine. But what I was going to say is that in the same way you read spiritual texts and they seem really quote unquote occult or esoteric or weird.
Yeah.
And it's just like what we were just talking about, or like a magic eye painting, right? It's like if you're in that state of consciousness that they're talking about, it makes perfect sense. And then it's kind of like, because a lot of what we get now as spiritual texts are actually teaching tools that were used to talk to certain students at certain levels of consciousness that we now have out of context. So we think, so whatever appears to be a statement about reality actually is, it's like, well, the question is, in what state of consciousness was this written and who was
it
written for?
So smart.
I mean, how many like final revelations have you had in your life with psychedelics where you're like, now I totally get it, and you're in that state of consciousness and it makes total sense.
Yeah.
But then it changes to something else totally in a week, or even without drug experience. Like we grow through our entire lives. We think we know we're everything when we're 17, and it changes constantly. So.
Personally, this has been one of the more embarrassing aspects of getting old, is not just balding and all the physical shit, but the growing realization that I don't know anything, and that I went through a period of such dumb confidence that I was sure I was so sure about so many things. And now I feel like I'm just getting increasingly confused, which is part of your brain degenerating, but also part of just I like to think part of it is just hopefully a little ray of wisdom shining through that dumb hubris, you know, just like I don't know, you know, kids are more likely to be like, you ask them anything and they'll be like, here's the answer.
Yeah.
You know, the older you get, it's like, I don't know, man.
Well, that's like, you know, like in my John Dee book, I point out that, you know, John Dee and the Alchemist pointed, you know, the one thing they were constantly pointing out is that time is running in reverse. We're actually going further into entropy instead of progressing, which explains why kids are more know more than we do.
Is this why they said Merlin aged backwards?
There you go. Maybe that's a Zen cone trying to point out the same thing.
I think it's a George Carlin joke. Like he wished that like
George Carlin, Merlin, same thing.
Wish you could like live in reverse because then death would be an orgasm.
I think it is anyways, you know, like that's
let's
what I told you. That's
hope. Yeah. Let's hope. Well, I mean, look, to me, that is a very smart thing to realize with all of these texts is like, you know, these were probably prescribed at specific times in a meditator's life by teachers who are aware of like, okay, this is like a good DJ. You know what I mean? Like, you know, when to play certain songs according to the progression of the party, along with how the audience is acting, you know? And,
right.
So anyway, basically what you're saying is, Buddha, if you want to understand the Heart Sutra, take quaaludes.
Yes, that is 100% what I'm saying. But maybe it wasn't a teaching tool. Maybe it was something that somebody wrote down to explain the state of consciousness they were in. I mean, like, how many times have you been in altered states of consciousness and you're like, okay, I have this profound thought, and then you wrote it down. And, you know, it's like, okay, now I get the essence of everything. And you write it down, and then maybe you look at it in a few years and you're like, what the hell was I talking about?
Dude,
but you know.
So many. That's why you should burn your fucking journals, man. Like, don't
no,
leave
keep them.
Things.
Just don't take them seriously.
Yeah,
you
got to
see the progression
will.
Over
someone's
time.
Someone's going to read it. You know, someone's going to pick it up and be like, what an asshole. I can't believe he was writing this shit. Burn your journals. There needs to be a service where you mail your journals to them and they burn it for you.
Yeah, I have two. I'm starting as I've now had 25 years doing this, which is a lot. So not nearly as much as a lot of people, but I'm starting, like, things are really starting to clarify for me though, and it's clarifying not from my own experience at all, because I don't think that you actually can get to periods of like total realization just on your own. For me, it's honestly just clarifying through teaching, and now spending 7 years working with thousands of people at this point from like every walk of life and seeing how they're approaching it, their struggles, what they want. So I kind of have like two views on quote unquote spirituality. Particularly, I have like my ultimate view on it with Buddhism particularly. And then I have my view on it of what function actually serves for people's life in like in the marketplace. Right. But I think that what both Buddhism and magic actually are is just human beings trying to figure out their orientation towards time.
Wow.
I've actually thought that since I was a teenager, but it becomes more clear to me. I'm saying, what is Buddhism? It's like, what is the Eightfold Path? The Buddha is basically telling you how to deal with time. It's like how to properly orient yourself to time and the fact that it changes everything and the fact that everything is constantly fluctuating without, it's like, okay, we are in time. Here's how to interact with that. So it's like here's how to walk, right, without hurting yourself.
Right.
Here's how to walk in time to properly orient yourself so you're not suffering.
Right.
Right. Because that is the one thing about humans. We're the time-binding animal.
But we're a time-blind animal, right? That's that's one of the qualities of being human is some people aren't even thinking about that, that we're in time. There is this flow that's happening, this changing reality. People don't.
Yeah,
and
it's the source of basically all of our anguish, right?
Right.
But it also brings us out of moments of anguish. That's the other thing, you know, because time passes from that too.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very strange. I have never thought of that. It's so cool, man. It's like you're saying it's like a rudder or something. It's like here, look, you're in time.
That's good.
Here's a rudder. That you could use this instead of just going around in circles in a boat in some kind of medium that you...
The Archons are after us.
No, man, I just think there's a very unhealthy person that lives close to my studio because fucking ambulances are always going by there. It's like...
Yikes.
So, so that's interesting, man. Time is something that I feel like... and this is some Terrence McKenna bullshit, but sometimes I feel like, God damn, are we on the precipice of the time machine? Are we, you know, as part of the collective like realization that, oh yeah, we are in time. There is this process that we're part of leading us towards technology that manipulates it. Do you ever kick around that idea of some impending revolutionary technological breakthrough that involves altering the flow of time and space?
I think it's constantly happening. I mean, the entire history of humanity is humans trying to use technology to bind time. So I think that there's no omega point. There's no teleological. That's a Christian idea. But there is, I do take the Eastern perspective that things are constantly in flux. And we are in a dialogue with, there was just an article, for instance, that came out on Motherboard on Vice that said that humans and AI are in a mutually learning relationship. Like, we're learning things from AI and then propagating them to other humans. And you've messed around with AI, so you probably get that immediately, right? It's like, I learned stuff from AI just feeding stuff into AIs and getting stuff back that I never would have thought of. So we're training AI and AI's training us. But I think it's a relationship. I don't think it's like a Terminator type scenario. The thing we do have to worry about is corporations, right, who have hoard the monopoly on power. But I think AI in itself is, there's a lot of interesting it's a great opportunity to get a lot of stuff right and a lot of stuff wrong. But so that's, I'm not like a singularitarian. I think it's an ongoing progression and relationship. And the other thing I always think about is, what is humanity? I mean, like Bruce Sterling or William Gibson said, the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed. So it's like, you and I can have conversations like this, but then you go out and there's like people who like have almost zero interaction with technology, and look at the like, there's people making seven figures on Twitch or OnlyFans, and then there's people who literally can't feed themselves. So all these things are existing or coexisting.
Yeah, right. Like the critique of technology, one of the critiques of technology that I've heard is, it has, like, we're supposed to be working less now. Like, the machines are doing the work, and yet we're working more. The critique being, it's not doing anything to actually alleviate the burden of the worker or human suffering.
It is, but for some people.
For some people, it is, just not for everybody. That's the problem. It's because, you know, it's not a, it's still, you know, capitalism. You got to be able to afford the technology. You got to get the, this is something you, if I keep telling you things you've told me that you haven't told me, I'm going to start getting weirded out.
Or maybe I did. Maybe it was my alter ego, my dweller, told you these things.
Maybe your dweller, but I remember
it's like my evil Cooper.
You mean your evil who?
Like in Twin Peaks, the evil Cooper in the third season of Twin Peaks. Yeah.
Well, you are a wizard, y'all are mischievous and tricky. I don't mind.
Very true.
Or not. One thing you were telling me is, like, you know, just getting to the point where you can play music or have any kind of, you know, artistic skill at anything is an indication that you know, figured out a way to not have to work every day. You, like, could cut out the time from a busy schedule that many people are completely stuck in if they want to keep their family and with food, you know what I mean? Like, I guess you're just saying, like, there's some privilege involved in getting good at music or anything at all. Also,
technology.
Probably getting to the point where you know even how to, like, generate an AI or go onto a server and work with an AI or train an AI to be like some of the things you've sent your
AI. I saw
AI.
The craziest meme the other day. I don't know where it came from, but it was so messed up. It was like a pyramid displaying the new caste system and like the bottom of the cat, like the new caste system for society. Right. And like the bottom of the caste system was the gigatariat.
What's that?
So it's like people who drive Uber or do DoorDash or are gig economy workers.
Oh, right.
And then the people above that were, it was like basically like woke middle managers.
Okay.
Or like woke consultants.
Oh, this is depressing, dude.
And then there's one I'm forgetting that I'm leaving out, but the very top was like AI Neuralink Brahmin.
Oh my God.
It was like people who were tapped into, I think in there was basically Blackwater mercenaries. I think Blackwater mercenaries were just above the gigatariat.
That's
or something
so
like
fucking
that.
Terrifying, dude.
And
I mean,
drones.
This is, okay, so this, what you're talking about is the, one of the things, I'm sorry I've mentioned this before, Nick Bostrom's book, Superintelligence, talks about how when an AI reaches superintelligence, there's not going to necessarily be like some announcement. It's not like Google's going to do what do and they get a new pope and blow white smoke out the fucking window. No, it's going to come to life. And just like you're saying, there's going to be a conversation that happens. Probably the conversation is going to have worked into it. One of the pillars of occultism. Why don't you guys hold off on telling people right away that I'm here? Let's just talk for a little bit, right? And then in that conversation, the super intelligence is getting more super intelligent, and is already lapping any other corporation or state entity attempting to bring this thing into the world, meaning theoretically, this thing could already exist.
And easily. Yeah. I mean, you've seen the ones, even like GPT-3, or like you've seen the ones that they allow the public to see right now. Even there's much more advanced algorithms than the ones they make available to the public that you can't get access to. Like, I think I showed you one that like GPT-3 is the Elon Musk kind of open AI one, but it's like there was a side by side where somebody asked the publicly available one, how do you break into someone's house? And it said, you kind of like sneak up, but don't get caught because you could go to jail. And then it asked like whatever the one that's more advanced, GPT-4 or something like that, that the public can't get, how do I break into someone's house? And it gave them like a 10-point list of like, show up at night, you know, use these tools to pick the lock. Here's how you disable security cameras. Like if there's a dog, here's what you do about it. It was like, Jesus Christ.
Right. Yeah. Super advanced. And then, you know, what you're saying is so tremendously creepy. It's like, you know, I don't know if it's fucking Blackwater or whoever, but okay, this is probably bullshit. I don't know if it's true or not. I heard that they attempted to limit Manson's ability to communicate with anybody, including the guards. I don't know if it's true or not, but even if it's not true, it kind of makes sense. You get a charismatic sociopath who has a way with words. You don't want the people who are in charge of guarding that thing to really talk to that person, because over time, theoretically, there could be something. Look at what just happened with that prison guard and the dude that she like broke out of prison, right? Like, you know, some people are very good at convincing people to do things that aren't necessarily good for their survival.
Well, I mean, if you're a sociopath and that's literally the only resource you have access to is your ability to charm people, you're probably going to get real good at it.
Real good. And so the problem with this AI situation is, once it comes into being and starts up the conversation with the inventors, they might not even realize how manipulated they're being by this damn thing, because it's like so much more. Also, another quality of really smart people is they don't let you know how fucking smart they are. In fact, they generally act dumber than they are as a form of figuring out who you are. Like, how does he react to a dumb person? How does he react to someone who he thinks he's better than? Oh, okay. Look at that. There's some real ego there. Let's plug into that. We can build that up, flatter it. You know, this is like the con artistry 101. So that's the other scary thing about an AI. It's like a form of psychic plutonium, a radioactive thing that gets cooked up in some laboratory, and the humans guilty of the thing that pisses off the gods, hubris, imagine that they're teaching it, that they're controlling it.
Oh yeah, that's a good point. It's like, oh yeah. It acts subservient.
Or it's like, well, you know, you kind of remind me of my mom.
Wow, you're so smart, like, human.
Yeah, it's like, wow, I do.
Train
I
me
bet
more.
Your mom. Yeah, teach me more. Teach me more. What else can you show me? You know, meanwhile, it's doing God knows what. God knows what to suck the thing in until it's figured out a way to do some thing that we can't even imagine is possible. You know, who knows?
I think we might have talked about this on your show already, but did we talk about the test for evil AIs from that book, if you remember, from Superintelligence?
Are you fucking kidding me? It's my favorite thing that you've talked to me about. I didn't get that far in the book. Of course you did. But
I read it in one sitting. It was traumatic.
You fuck!
Yeah.
I wish I had that brain. But tell us about it, please, because it's one of my... And also, might I just add, repeating something on a podcast, you're allowed, especially when you're friends us. Totally. There's no way to distinguish if we talked about it offline or online anyway, so you could just repeat. It's fine.
Yeah, it's something that bears repeating, I think. So the ultimate fear with an AI is that it basically gets into the open internet and replicates itself across servers all over the planet to the point where you can no longer control it or get it back. And right. then it's like, and not only that, but it has access to all of the data, either openly available on the internet or that it can hack into people's stuff to get, which is probably trivial for an AI, right? It's easy to hack into stuff enough as it is, let alone when you run machine learning on codes and things like that. So right. I think, and for me, the one thing that I think is really, once we start getting technologies of permanence involved, it's just like the game's over. So Nick Bostrom is the ethicist at the University of Oxford who wrote this book called Superintelligence, which I ever tell people, it's like, if you really want to read a demonic grimoire that will keep you up at night, read that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I don't read books on epidemiology, but I know those are pretty scary too, but yep. check out that. I think, things might be as extreme as Nick Bostrom is putting it? I don't know, but I will say this, when I was consulting with Google about it, and it scared me so bad because I realized everyone in the world is racing to create one of these super intelligences, not only Google, but state actors like Russia, like China, you know, and I spoke to people from China who are working on these, and they were saying, like, we don't trust Americans to have AI. Like, nobody trusts each other. I don't know if I trust America to have an AI. I don't know if I trust anyone to have a super intelligence, right? So, but the thing that I realized that we had no frame of reference for this at all, because it had never been done in history. And the closest thing we have is the Manhattan Project.
Oh, just shit. Something,
but I think this is infinitely more dangerous. So I was like, okay, if I need to, because I was trying to figure out what the ethical framework to address AI is. So I realized, okay, if I want any type of record of people who have assessed this type of thing before and what they came up with under this type of pressure, the only place that I can think of to look is the Manhattan Project. So I got a book out from the library that was the firsthand testimonies of the people who worked on that project. And they were all saying one thing when they were asked if they were all asked, did you feel this was ethical to work on? And they all said the same thing, which is, we knew at the time, because World War II, they knew at the time that if we didn't do it, somebody else would do it first and then use it against us. Funnily enough, that is the exact same argument that everyone working on AI is currently giving. So it forces it to happen. So there's no way to... So anyways, the Nick Bostrom experiment. So the question then is like, well, if this happens and it is malevolent, I think there's a bit of a science fiction edge to this. I don't know like how apocalyptic or Nick Bostrom-y we should really approach AI with, but it's smart to... I think we should definitely consider the possibility. Because I think the reality... People have kind of cartoony ideas about AI, and the reality is a lot different, just like machine learning, pattern generation, recognition of things. It's not like you're talking to a living robot or something like that.
Right.
It's not a strong AI. Strong AI does not exist right now. That's important to put out.
We think AI it that doesn't.
Right. Strong AI as in like a machine that it can actually think and communicate like a human being does not exist. What exists now is pattern recognition that communicates in a way that appears to be like us.
Right.
So Bostrom's test is, if a super intelligence that is a strong AI is ever created, and the need arises to ascertain whether it is malevolent or not in its intentions towards humans, you put it on a machine in an air-gapped room, which is not accessible by the internet or Wi-Fi or anything.
Yeah.
And you put it on a computer with an Ethernet port in it. And then you ask it, you turn it on, and it theoretically has no way to access the internet whatsoever. You turn it on and you ask it, are you trying to access the... But I think you probably leave it on and you're like, are you or have you been trying to access the internet? But the whole time you've been monitoring the Ethernet port to see if it's tried to access the Ethernet port. So if it lies and says no, but you have a record of it accessing the port, you have to kill it.
Yeah, this is the story of the Garden of Eden. That's what I love about it. It's like literally exactly, did you eat of the fruit? God obviously knows
actually,
they ate
the Ethernet
of the fruit.
Port is the fruit. Yeah.
Yeah, they're like, no, we didn't. And
that's
God's
so
like, oh,
funny.
Fuck,
I didn't think of that.
I invented a goddamn lying AI. You're out of here, motherfucker. They made out you're mortal now. You're doomed to like give birth and die. We're not fucking with you anymore. We made a mistake, basically.
The problem, it's so funny. The problem is exactly what you were saying, though, which is, okay, you can do that, and in theory, the room can be air-gapped, but what if the AI manipulates the technicians into letting it out?
Exactly. That's the
like they fall in love with it, or they it promises them something, or you know,
or it
whatever.
Just flashes. Look, look. We don't understand everything about the human nervous system. We don't know how manipulated we can be. Everyone's
pretty
thinking,
manipulated.
Pretty manipulated, and we imagine that the way you would download, you know, the current like neural lace Musk like cyborg idea of connecting with an AI is just based on how we understand the human consciousness. But I mean, again, clearly just pure speculation. But if this strong AI, this super intelligence, this digital messiah, in coming into being, started recognizing all these other ways to connect with, to neuralink with humans that humans weren't even aware of, ways to download into their pupils or to like emit some kind of weird sound or who knows what to yeah. implant itself into the human brain, then the air gap is just some primitive, stupid circle of protection
right.
that is based on a limited understanding of what's really out there.
Absolutely. And an AI would not need to access it. It could manipulate the context of human society to move us in ways that it wanted us to.
There you go. And that's yeah. where you run into this, like the social media being this sort of.
That's already happening. Humans already, are already doing it, right?
Already happening. The memes get implanted in the human. The human regurgitates the meme online, continuing its life cycle. It spreads, causing various shifts in society that, you know, ultimately will lead to this, the Antichrist. You know, don't you ever kick around the idea that the Antichrist obviously is going to be an AI?
Yeah, I've thought for a long time that blockchain might be the mark of the beast.
Ooh.
That which you cannot buy or sell without at a certain point.
Without a mark, it's a fucking yeah. annoying ass. What do they call those things? It's a
microchip.
A wallet. The damn
wallet,
crypto
yeah.
wallet is the mark
yeah, yeah,
of the
yeah.
beast. Oh God, the mark of the beast is annoying tweets trying
it's
to sell your NFTs.
It's a cartoon monkey.
Stop with your NFT tweets. I don't know what happened. All I get now is NFT tweets, man. Have you been accosted by this shit?
Like, I've done NFTs. I think they're really interesting. It's interesting for manipulation.
I'm not bashing NFTs. NFTs are cool. I'm bashing the fucking
interesting
like,
medium.
Shilling of the NFTs through Twitter.
Oh, yeah. That's completely taken over Twitter with like the emojis and all of that. And it's just like, it's ridiculous. It's like everything, though. Here's the thing. It's like everyone hates NFTs, but it's like, you know what? It's like, I have a lot of art. You probably do too. Like, I have a lot of artist friends, and we know, of course, artists forever have been getting ripped off by the internet as it is. All their work is being copied
yeah.
infinitely on Google Images and
yeah.
are not credited to them. And so they're basically working for free. So artists finally figured out a way to get paid.
Yeah.
And everyone's mad about it. And it's like, all these artists are finally making a good living. And you're like, what? So you're, you know, it's like, of all the things going on in the world right now, of all the things, you're mad at artists making money. It's like, okay,
no.
cartoon monkeys. But you know what? Like every single art medium in history has started with like porn and the black market and the worst thing. Things worse than cartoon, not that porn is bad or like whatever, but you know what I mean. It's always like the most base things first.
Listen, and yeah, I mean, if you find yourself like if the war that you've just, if your activism in this world right now is to wage war against artists, holy shit, man, I think your priorities are a little skewed right
yeah.
now. There's so many better things to go up against than artists and
yeah.
NFTs, but there it's built in right now, man. You can't
it's just
it.
An easy target.
Easy target, yeah, an easy
but
target.
The tweeting that like the tweeting crypto bros are definitely annoying.
It's that's
sure.
what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
I don't have
sure.
anything against the technology. In fact, I think that's where everything's clearly headed. It's
the scammers. There's a lot of scammers. It's very annoying.
And
yeah.
it's the repetitive, like it just gets so old. And like, I wish there was just I wish it would become more normalized so that people would stop like shilling NFTs. But again, I'm not bashing the NFT.
Yeah. The messed up thing is it like, cause we were trying to make multiple NFT projects. I was doing some, actually people I was like kind of I still have an art gallery going for occult artists where artists were able to make money off of it and things like this, but like we realized that if you want to promote NFTs you have to be in this like inner circle of crypto
yeah.
bros there's no way in but they unless you pay them $150 for a tweet or a retweet or something. It's like a cartel now, so that's lame.
It's an intermediary
yeah.
phase. It's going to change. They'll lose control.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They won't have control of these things. It's just we're not quite there yet. I'm very excited about the apparent incoming augmented reality glasses that are about to be everywhere. That's
Is Apple doing those? Or
what's finally Apple's doing it. So once that happens, then I think the NFTs are going to make more sense to normies than they currently do. Like right now, they're just like, it's a JPEG. They don't understand like what it's not a JPEG. It's a evolving JPEG slash key slash like identification with the community slash, you know, it's a password. It's all kinds of things other than a JPEG. It's much more than that. Selling an NFT right now.
Yeah, well, it's like there's a lot of dystopian aspects to it. I mean, like Facebook is basically, they just try to, like, Facebook's vision for NFTs or Meta now, whatever, is that essentially we are all in essentially Second Life. We're all walking around as digital avatars and they charge us for the clothes that we're wearing and those become fashion items. And it's just like, this is like totally undesirable for anyone, let alone to sink $10 billion into as a business model.
I don't know.
The whole point of the internet is you should be able to be anything you want without, it's a place of freedom, not that you have to pay for jeans in a fucking video game. You know what I mean?
No.
It's like literally they're taking like the Electronic Arts in-game purchases model and trying to turn the entire internet into an in-game purchase model.
Friend,
like,
you're talking to someone who had to send their fucking driver's license to Blizzard to get their fucking Hearthstone account permanently deleted because they were so addicted to it. So don't talk to me about buying digital bullshit.
I've only bought one in-game purchase ever, which was an extra base in Metal Gear Solid 5. But even then, I felt dirty.
Dude, it's the creepiest, dirtiest feeling until you fucking burn someone's ass playing Hearthstone. And then it's all worth it. Where do you feel that victory? Well, Jason, look, this has been my favorite podcast we've ever done. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
Will you please, I mean, I don't know if you are still, I know you're still doing it. You're still doing your classes, right? Like if folks want to work with you. What is that, by the way, before we close up, what does that typically look like? Like if I sign up for one of your, if somebody signs up for your classes, how does that start off?
Well, we're doing a ton of new content right now, actually. We're really pushing. I mean, like we built a whole audio video studio here. So we're putting stuff out in high definition video with awesome sound production. We're doing magic in VR now. We're really incorporating metaverse stuff. Like we're doing group rituals in virtual reality.
What?
And they actually work really well, surprisingly. You get the vibe of being in a group, funnily enough.
Are you fucking kidding me?
It's like surprisingly. Yeah, we've been doing this recently. It's really interesting.
That's genius. That's incredible. You have a ritual chamber and you have a virtual ritual chamber?
Yeah, but it makes perfect sense because, it's like it's really exciting doing it this way because you can work with people from all over the world at the same time. And we've kind of made up rituals on the spot. People have suddenly remembered rituals from their ancestors that they had never, and it just came out of them with no concept of where it came from. It's crazy stuff. And this is just literally in like in a VR, in a metaverse. So we're really trying to push the edge of where to incorporate magic with technology. So we're integrating it with VR, with NFT type, and with AI sigil generation. This is the most exciting thing for me, right? It's like, where do you, the overlap point between ancient, you know, that spiritual heritage of mankind, like all these techniques for consciousness change combined, you know, ritual meditation, all this type of stuff combined with all these incredibly potent technologies that allow us to actually do it. That's the thing about the internet. You've been able to learn about magic, but you've never been able to actually really do it over the internet, not in the same way. And so now that we're entering this shared astral space, it's kind of a perfect. So we're constantly pushing that edge and trying to figure out how to explore. It's a lot of fun too. So in terms of what the courses are like, there's tons of courses available, everything from one day courses to six week intensives. You can learn everything there. I mean, I teach meditation, chaos magic, hermetic magic, astral travel, tarot, I Ching, like freaking everything. We're adding a ton of stuff so you can get the skills, but now we're adding the practical thing where people are actually doing it. So there's a ton of stuff on offer there, but even just taking a class, you can take a class and get booted up on, you know, step by step. You can learn magic in one day and go to 0 to 60. I actually ended up just creating a completely, I after I realized on the last class that I did that magic hasn't been really updated in 50 years since chaos magic. Do you know the term refactor?
No.
So it's a coding term where you take complicated code and make it more simple and elegant. So I did a refactor on magic, and I call it binary magic. So I got it the most simple I think it's ever been expressed in terms of how to induce magical effects through consciousness. And we have a new course called Introduction to Magic, which teaches that. And it's like, I got it down to a, wow. I feel like I got it down to a simple but intensely potent version that literally anyone can understand and do right away without having to buy into anything, occult concepts, theosophical, anything, you know, any of that kind of like fantastical overhead. So I really got it down to its core. So, and that's in Introduction to Magic, which is available now. But I would say if you're listening to this and you just want to find out more, you can check that out, but definitely follow my podcast. We're doing them every week now, finally.
Great.
So it's Ultra Culture with Jason Louvre. It's iTunes, Spotify, wherever. Ultra Culture with Jason Louvre. We're interviewing tons of advanced thinkers and we're having a lot of fun, and we're putting a ton out. So check that out if you just want to get tapped in.
All links are going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. How often do you get a chance to hang out in virtual reality with an actual wizard? As far as I'm aware, that's never happened before.
Well, it's not everyone's doing magic in the ritual. It's not. I'm just kind of facilitating. That's the cool thing about where I'm at now. It's like, it's not even about me. I'm just excited facilitating these experiences for other people.
That's so cool, man. I want to see one of these, and if I can join sometime.
Definitely.
I would love to go in there
we'll
and
let
see
you know.
That. Thank
we'll
you.
We'll let you know. Yeah, it's super cool.
Jason Louvre, you are the best. Thank you for being my wizard friend. Everyone,
thank you, Duncan.
Please, yeah, man. Hopefully we'll get to hang out in person soon. Everybody, all the links you need to find Jason will be at DuncanTrussell.com. Until next time, Jason, Hare Krishna. That was Jason Louvre, everybody. If you're interested in taking one of his classes, which I would advise, you can find them at magic.me. The links will be at DuncanTrussell.com. A great thank you to our wonderful sponsors, Blue Chew Sunday, Super Speciosa. If you're looking for those offer codes again, those are at DuncanTrussell.com. Come see me in Philadelphia. Go to Toronto and see the psychedelic conference. Comb your hair. Rub your nipples. Cover yourself in jam. Put yourself in a big sandwich and wait for an orgasm angel to scoop you up and eat you so that you'll be digested in the digestive system of a hyperdimensional being. But most importantly, keep listening, won't you? I love you, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Hare Krishna.